Key Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Faith Perlow tells us about efforts to make giant rats more appealing to the American public. Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Faith Perlow.
Three zoos in the United States, including the San Diego Zoo, now have hero rat ambassadors, showing the abilities of the African giant pouched rats. A Tanzania-based organization that trains the rats provided them to the zoos. The rats use their sense of smell to perform useful tasks, like detecting diseases and landmines, helping fight wildlife trafficking, and more. Runa is the giant pouched rat at the San Diego Zoo. She was trained to find landmines. The rats can detect landmines and explosive materials in former war areas in countries like Angola, Mozambique, and Cambodia. But Runa was a little distracted doing that job. Carrie and Sarah, a wildlife care specialist at the San Diego Zoo, said Runa is now doing well as a rat ambassador. Recently, Runa used her sense of smell to find small amounts of tea that her trainers had hidden under dirt in a box. Once she found the tea, she was given a reward of a pellet and banana drink. One of the most fun things to see is how she changes the perceptions of people, Insara said. Nikki Boyd works for the San Diego Zoo and Wildlife Alliance. She said the zoo wants to show that rats are an important tool for fighting wildlife trafficking. She said that the illegal animal trade is very destructive to the species that we are actively trying to save and protect in the wild. In March, six African rats finished training to find trafficked goods in a port in Tanzania. The wildlife is hidden in large shipping containers that leave the port of Dar es Salaam. Some of the goods include pangolins, a scaly anteater that is one of the most trafficked animals in the world. Its meat is eaten as a delicacy in parts of Asia, and its scales are used in traditional Chinese medicine. But rats still have a long way to go to improve their public image. Eric Adams is the mayor of New York City. Recently, he appointed Kathleen Quarati to help with the city's rat problem. During a news conference, Quarati talked about her hatred of rats and promised to use science to remove them. Rats can spread diseases like leptospirosis, which can lead to kidney and liver failure. A New York City spokesperson called the city's rats dirty and diseased. He said that they are a public health risk and that the city will remove the rats in a humane way when possible, but that the city will put the needs of the people first. Izzy Zott is a research scientist for the Belgian nonprofit group APOPO. The group trains rats to work for governments around the world. She hopes that having the ambassador rats at famous zoos will help people understand and support rat research. Zott said that rats are actually quite clean animals. She added they clean themselves and lick their trainer's arms with affection. APOPO said that African giant pouched rats have found more than 150,000 landmines. The rats have also helped identify tuberculosis bacteria from 25,000 patients at African hospitals. In Tanzania, Zott said researchers are training rats to identify pollution and to find people buried in destroyed buildings after disasters. Zott added that she thinks giant pouched rats will be used at ports and airports in the future and may replace dogs to smell for explosives and drugs. The common brown rat found in New York City has similar abilities, but they live only a few years, so it is unlikely that they could be trained. African rats can live up to 10 years. Speaking of the African pouched rat, Zott said that the rat ambassadors will show just how smart they are and how we can coexist with them. I'm Faith Perlow.
NASA showed off a simulated Mars environment this month where four volunteers will live for 1 year to help the American Space Agency prepare to send humans to the planet. The volunteers, who are not astronauts, are expected to enter the environment called a habitat in June. It was built at a major research base at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. During their stay, crew members will take part in many different activities, NASA said in a statement. This will include taking part in simulated spacewalks, doing robotic work, caring for the habitat, exercising, and planting crops. The 160-square-meter habitat is also designed to recreate environmental pressures that future visitors to Mars could face. Examples of this will be carrying out activities with limited resources, being isolated, and experiencing equipment failures, NASA said. The simulated environment was built using 3D printing technology. 3D printers have been used in recent years to build increasingly large structures, including entire homes. The Mars habitat is part of a NASA program known as the Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog, or CHAPEA. It is expected to include a total of three simulated environments. Grace Douglas is the lead researcher of the CHAPEA experiments. She told the French news agency, AFP, that NASA has been looking at 3D printing technology as a possible way to build habitats on other planetary or lunar surfaces. NASA officials are still in the early stages of preparing for a mission to Mars. However, most of the agency's current efforts support upcoming Artemis missions, which aim to return humans to the moon for the first time in half a century. While in the habitat, NASA workers will continuously follow the volunteers' physical and mental health. With that data, NASA will be better equipped to study how astronauts can learn to use only the resources they have, Douglas said. We can really start to understand how we're supporting them with what we're providing them, she said. And that's going to be really important information to making those critical resource decisions, she added. The habitat includes an outdoor area that simulates the Martian surface and environment. That area, however, will still be within the simulated environment. The volunteers who will take part in the first experiment have not yet been named. NASA says the process of choosing the individuals will follow the same guidelines that are used to choose astronauts. The team members will be expected to have rich backgrounds in science, technology, engineering, and math. In addition, only American citizens or permanent U.S. residents can be chosen. Interested individuals have to be between 30 and 55 years old, in good physical health, and have no dietary issues or motion sickness. Former Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield told the Associated Press in 2021 that he thinks the requirements show that NASA is looking for people who are close to being astronauts. That, he noted, is a good thing because it will make the experiment better. A past Russian effort to create a simulated Mars environment called Mars 500 was not highly successful, Hadfield said. This is because the people involved were too much like everyday people, he added. For the right person, this could be great, Hadfield said. He spent 5 months in orbit in 2013 at the International Space Station. Just think how much you're going to be able to catch up on Netflix, Hadfield joked. If they have a musical instrument there, you could go into there knowing nothing and come out a concert musician, if you want, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to talk more about this week's science report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Sure, Ashley. Glad to be back.
Your report centered on NASA's creation of a simulated Mars environment on Earth to study how humans are affected by living in such conditions. The report notes the people who will enter the environment will not be astronauts. Did NASA say why this is? And what kind of people will be chosen for the experiment?
Yes, so NASA officials have said the four people taking part in the project, who will spend 1 year in the habitat, will not be actual astronauts, but they will have a lot of the same background and specific skills. And NASA noted the guidelines for choosing the right candidates will be very similar to those used to choose astronauts.
And we also learned in the report that the habitat structure was created through 3D printing technology. Has NASA given many details about that?
Yes, so NASA says it used a 3D printer made by an American company called Icon. This is the same company that in 2018 completed the first 3D printed home in the U.S. The material used to build the habitat is called lavacrete. It's a very strong concrete mixture designed for creating larger structures. And, of course, the mix used is the same color as the sand and rocks found on the surface of Mars.
So where is the habitat, and when will the individuals start the experiment?
So the habitat sits at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. And the team members are expected to begin the experiment in June.
That's soon. Well, thanks again, Brian, for joining me on the program.
You're welcome, Ashley. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Growing tensions in Europe and Asia created a serious conflict for Americans during the 1930s. Most Americans opposed the fascist or military leaders gaining control in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other countries. But they were not willing to take any firm action to stop this growing movement. Americans did not want to become involved in another world war, and they called on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan finally would force Americans to choose between their love of democracy and their desire for peace. The first challenge to America's policy of neutrality came in October 1935. Troops from fascist Italy invaded Ethiopia. Roosevelt did not feel neutral at all. He told his advisors, "Italy is dropping bombs on Ethiopia, and that is war." He sharply criticized the fascist Italian leader Benito Mussolini. Roosevelt issued an order banning Americans from sending arms to either Italy or Ethiopia, and he called on Americans not to send oil or other materials to Italy. Roosevelt's efforts to stop the export of oil and other products did not succeed, but the efforts by the White House played an important part in leading the League of Nations to take economic actions against Italy. Less than 2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. Spanish fascists led by General Francisco Franco tried to overthrow the democratic government in Madrid. Some Americans went to join the democratic army in Spain to fight Franco. But Roosevelt and the Congress agreed that America should remain officially neutral in the conflict. In this way, Roosevelt was meeting the wishes of the American people by avoiding war. But personally, he was deeply troubled by the events in Europe. In a letter to his ambassador in France, Roosevelt wrote, "One cannot help feeling that the whole European situation is blacker than at any time in your lifetime or mine." Another challenge to American neutrality came in Asia. Japan launched a new invasion of China in July 1937. Within 1 month, Japanese forces gained control of what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. The United States had long supported the nationalist forces of China, and many Americans were angry about the Japanese invasion. But Roosevelt and his administration once again refused to take strong actions against the aggression. For one thing, the American Navy was weak. There was little it could do to stop Japanese aggression thousands of miles away in Asia. And neither Roosevelt nor the Congress wanted to be the first to break America's official policy of neutrality. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in private talks with friends that he understood the serious threat to world peace created by Adolf Hitler and other fascists. He believed that the United States could not remain neutral forever if democracy was threatened in so many countries. However, Roosevelt did little to educate the nation about this threat. Instead, he generally followed the wishes of the majority of people who wanted America to remain neutral. Public opinion in the United States was strongly against any kind of involvement in foreign conflicts. In 1937, Roosevelt made an important speech calling for the world's neutral nations to protect themselves from lawless fascist nations. But many Americans feared that Roosevelt was trying to create a new alliance, and they opposed his efforts. A public opinion survey at the time showed that less than one in three Americans was willing to change the nation's strong neutrality laws to give Roosevelt more freedom of action. In the same year, Japanese planes sank an American gunboat in the Yangtze River in China. But few Americans showed any interest in going to war over the incident. Instead, they accepted Japanese apologies. Americans simply had no desire to fight. Most Americans honestly believed that the best hope for their country was neutrality. One of the most influential supporters of neutrality was Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. He told the New York Times in 1937 that there can be no objection to any action the government may take which tries to bring peace to the world. But that action, he added, must not tie the American people into another world death march. He said, "I very much fear that we are once again being caused to feel that the call is upon America to police a world that chooses to follow insane leaders." Adolf Hitler's Nazi forces moved into the Rhineland in 1936. 2 years later, they invaded Austria. And then, in the following months, Hitler began making demands on the government of Czechoslovakia. Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was afraid that Hitler might start a general European war if he was blocked from gaining control of Czechoslovakia. In September of 1938, Chamberlain traveled to Munich to discuss the situation with the German leader. The result was that Britain agreed to a German takeover of Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain returned to London, promising peace in our time.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The first reaction of most Americans to Chamberlain's Munich Agreement was one of relief. But then public opinion changed. Americans saw that Hitler's Germany now had control of Central Europe. Japan was becoming more powerful in Asia. Chamberlain's weakness only served to show dictators that they could gain land and power through aggression and fear. Roosevelt warned Americans in late 1938 about this fascist threat. "There can be no peace," he said, "if another nation makes the threat of war its national policy."
There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the threat of war. There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the dispersion all over the world of millions of helpless and persecuted wanderers with no place to lay their heads. There can be no peace if humble men and women are not free to think their own thoughts, to express their own feelings, and to worship God. There can be no peace if economic resources that ought to be devoted to social and economic reconstruction are to be diverted to an intensified competition in armaments.
Roosevelt and much of the American public continued to hope that the United States could stay out of foreign conflicts. But increasingly they understood that war might come, and they began to prepare for possible hostilities. Following the Munich Agreement, Roosevelt requested a large increase in the defense budget. He asked Britain and France to buy arms from American manufacturers to give those companies more experience in producing weapons. And he helped bring about an agreement among nations in North and South America to join together to oppose fascist threats to peace and security. Finally, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to change the neutrality laws. He wanted more freedom as president to resist fascist aggression and help Britain, France, China, and other friendly nations. Congress, however, continued to resist such changes. But events in early 1939 showed that war was on the way. Germany occupied Czechoslovakia and then Lithuania. Franco's forces took control in Spain. Italy invaded Albania. And then Hitler began making demands on Poland. In August, Germany and the Soviet Union announced to the world that they had signed a non-aggression agreement. A week later, Germany attacked Poland. Two days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Germany's invasion of Poland and the beginning of the war presented a giant challenge to the United States. On the one hand, almost all Americans supported the European democracies opposing the aggression by Hitler, Mussolini, and other fascists. But on the other hand, Americans had no desire to fight in what might be a long and bloody war. The following months would force Americans of all political beliefs to consider this problem. It would be a final period of peace for the United States before events once again drew it into a terrible world conflict.
And that
that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.